Hi, everyone. I'm Katie Couric, and welcome to Next Question. Today, I have such a treat for you, a man you are certainly familiar with. He can make you laugh.
All right, everyone, gird your loins.
He can make you swoon.
Julia, you are the butter to my bread and the breath to my life. I love you, darling girl.
And he can also make a mean Negroni.
You can do it on the rocks. It's kind of really nice to have it up.
It's Stanley Tucci, everyone's favorite pandemic sauce man. Enjoy.
Are we doing the thing right now, or are we?
Yeah, we're doing it right now. This is it,
baby.
Oh, we're
doing it right now? Well, I wasn't sure if it.
Yeah. Okay. I'm so happy to see you, and I know that
I'm really happy to see you too.
I really appreciate that you've, Stanley, been able to cram me into your very, very busy schedule.
God.
Because what can I say? There's been a Tucci-sance.
Yeah, Tucci.
Am I right?
Yes, I think so. Yes, which, yeah, is wonderful and embarrassing. Yes.
Well, I think it's just plain wonderful, and I'm not embarrassed at all. But I want to ask you about all the different things you've been doing, Stanley, because you have been so busy. You have your CNN series about Italy. You have an upcoming book. You have a movie you just did with my sauce man, Colin Firth. I mean, you're also my sauce man, Stanley. But I have had a thing for Colin Firth for decades now.
Well, it's hard not to.
We're going to talk about Colin and your wonderful movie with him, and also about how you're delighting all your Instagram followers with your cocktails. And we'll talk about that and you and Felicity and how that all got started. But I thought we should start by talking about your extraordinary series on CNN, which I have to be honest, makes me very, very hungry. And since I've sworn off carbs, damn you, Stanley Tucci.
Is it like a brioche?
Yeah, it's like a brioche.
It looks like a brioche.
And it's even healthier as compared to this. This is a bomba con la crema. It's fried. It's a sort of donut with egg cream.
I can't imagine a better assignment for you, Stanley, because you're Italian on both sides. You're a foodie from way back, and you love to travel. So how much fun was this just exploring these regions, and what did you learn from the experience?
Well, I learned a great deal because we wanted to incorporate always not just that the idea of Italy. First of all, I wanted to sort of dispel the myth that Italy is, the food of Italy is pasta and pizza and chicken parmigiana, which is not an actual Italian dish.
Yes, I saw some of the innards that you were consuming, and I have to say, I think I would say check, please. I'm not an adventurous eater, Stanley.
Oh, no, but Katie, then we'll go out to dinner, and you will be. It'll be fine.
Okay.
I promise. You needn't be afraid. But I wanted to dispel that myth that, you know, pasta is with every meal, and the tomato is in everything, and so on and so forth. Yes, that's true in certain parts of Italy, but not all parts of Italy. Pasta gives way to polenta, which gives way to rice, and everything is cyclical and everything is seasonal. And the Italians still promote this and believe it and live by it. And I think that's one of the things that makes them their cuisine so attractive. But the idea that you can have cavolo nero, which is a black kale, that you have that in the north, but you don't necessarily have that in the south. That you have eggplant down in the south, but you don't have that. You never see an eggplant. You'll never see a tomato. You very seldom have pasta. But the other aspect was that I wanted to show Italy not in a completely romantic light, but to show it truthfully through its food. And as you delve into that food, specifically in each region, what you're going to end up delving into is the society. And every society has issues. And there is a huge amount of poverty in Italy to this day, not just in the South, but in the North as well. And there's a lot of prejudice. There's a lot of sort of, let's say, governmental confusion as to what a safety net should be and what a safety net shouldn't be. And you want to, in each episode, sort of shine a little bit of a light on that.
I think you do. You know, I was going to say, Stanley, I was taken with how you showed sort of these forces that were butting up against each other in an episode when you talked about kind of gentrification or trying to have new restaurants in this certain area and how they were being bombed. And that to me was a microcosm of some of the social issues that are happening everywhere. This reaction to multiculturalism, to disruption, etc.
Yeah, it's really interesting and it's very sad because to me, as an Italian American, you know, yes, when Italians came over, they came over because they were suffering terribly in Italy in the between the wars or prior to World War I. But to think that Italy would reject people in need when a lot of countries, America in particular, accepted so many Italians when they were in need is heartbreaking to me. And it's not that when the Italians came to America that they weren't vilified, that they weren't ostracized, that they weren't demonized. But ultimately, what they ended up doing was making our society so much better. And in Italy, there are those who really see the benefits of immigration, and there are those, particularly in the North, who don't. And one episode, the episode in Milan, I interview and spend time with a guy who is the sort of gamekeeper of Lake Como. And he looks after the health of the lake. He's a fisherman. And he's an ardent environmentalist. And yet, at the same time, and these things don't often go together, he's anti-immigration and he's part of the League, which is the right wing you know, a political group headed by Salvini. So there's a real dichotomy there, and we had a good conversation about it, but you know, he's a lovely guy with a great family and everything, but you just think if you could only see that the more diversity there is, the healthier a country is.
How did COVID affect the production schedule? And what was it like kind of taking this on in the middle of a global pandemic?
Well, we did the first four episodes prior to the pandemic. The second leg of it was done, just two episodes. It just makes it more complicated. It makes it harder. It's not as much fun. You want to follow all the protocols and be really careful. And every day you're learning something new at that point about COVID and but it was hard. It was hard. I mean, I have a friend of mine who's directing a series here now, excuse me, for Netflix. I think for Netflix, something. One of those. He told me that they've added $17 million to their budget simply for testing and COVID protocols.
Wow.
I'm doing something here and I'm tested. Once I start the job on Thursday, I think I'm tested 5 days a week. So if you think about hundreds of people, how much that costs. It's going to actually change the face of the film industry significantly, because the movie that I made with Colin will called Supernova, that we made for £3 million, you won't see a movie like that for quite a while.
Why is that?
Because of the protocols.
It just can't afford it.
No.
We'll talk about Supernova, but you don't really talk much about the pandemic in the series, which I thought was interesting. There would be maybe a mask here, an elbow bump there. Yeah. And was that a conscious decision? Because Italy was so devastated. And of course, we watched in horror as so many people were dying from this disease. Did you feel like it would date it? Or, you know, how did you decide how to handle that?
You know, I don't know. I don't know, Katie. I don't know why we didn't do that. I think we were all a bit shocked by it. And I think we just wanted to try to move forward because it was at a point where we thought that things were getting better. And, you know, you don't want to skirt the issue, but you also don't, it's not an investigative show.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's not that. You want to acknowledge it, but I'm going forward. I would like to talk more about that. I would like to talk more about the loss and also the success of the way the Italians handled it from the get-go.
You may get a chance to do that because I know you're doing another season. Is it going to be searching for Italy or is it going to be searching for the UK? What are you going to be searching next, Stanley?
Well, we're going to search different regions. We're going to do six different regions.
Six different regions of the world, or
no, Italy.
Oh, you're doing more Italy, though.
Yeah. You seem bored by that.
No, not at all. I'm excited about it. In fact, I think for a lot of people, we just got so much vicarious pleasure, not only watching you eat, and I have to ask how you stay so thin, Stanley, because it's friggin' annoying to watch you eating all that stuff, and then to watch you, and you like look like you don't even have body fat. Anyway, but I think people just love watching it, especially because we are all desperate to travel. And I think us to see you enjoying, you know, these beautiful, fascinating places full of incredible people, I think. I loved, you know, meeting the people behind the food.
I think
it sort of spirited us away from our pandemic blues, if you will. So yeah. I love Italy and I'm happy you're doing more. I'm excited just to watch whatever you do, Stanley. So
thank you.
No, because you're so fun to watch and you're kind of easy to be with on television. I can't explain it, but do you know what I mean? You're just you just feel like a travel companion. So it's been really nice. But what's the response been? Are a lot of people saying that to you? Like it's just so much fun to see the world.
Yeah, it is.
It is.
You don't, you know, you have to be careful not to make it trite, as I said, not to make it, isn't Italy the most romantic place in the world? And yes, there's romance in Italy. There's romance everywhere. But, you know, there are darker aspects of every country, and we touch on them. But for me, it's really just about telling the truth of that country through its cuisine. And the cuisine is arguably I think it's the most beloved food in the world. If you said to anyone, do you like Italian food? Have you ever met a person who says no?
No.
No.
When we come back, how did Stanley become such a foodie? And how does he stay so damn fit? That's right after this. How do you stay so skinny, Stanley?
I exercise obsessively, and I'm blessed with a very fast metabolism. Really, I mean, really. I eat pasta like every day.
I hate people like you, Stanley. Yeah, but I know, that's okay.
I work out like a.
How did you become a foodie in the first place? Because this is not your first rodeo when it comes to kind of exploring cuisines. Can you take me back to your like food origin story where you thought, I really love food, and who influenced you? Because I sort of know the answer, but some of our listeners may not.
My family, my mother, my grandmother, on both sides. Food was everything. Sitting around the table at night was what you just did. You were not late for dinner. If you were, you were sort of roundly chastised. And my mother, and I write about this in the book, and my mother is an incredible cook. I mean, she's the kind of person that, I mean, had she chosen to be a professional chef, she would have been extraordinary, beyond. And I'm not saying this because, oh, every Italian boy loves his mother's cooking. You know, it's not like I've been around, you know, not in that sense, Katie, but in, you're just like, whoa, no matter where I travel, no matter where I go, I always go back to those flavors and that process. And when I find something new, it's great. But ultimately, that's the stuff that really works. I mean, really works. It's extraordinary.
Describe the Tucci family dinner table growing up, because I just want to have people get an image of it and what it was like, where it was, and kind of the commotion that would take place there.
Yeah, I mean, we're just in Westchester in our house and excuse me, in Katona, and we had this ranch house that my parents had built, which now would be, I mean, you couldn't buy a car for the price of the house and the whole thing. Beautiful house on a cul-de-sac in suburbia. My dad came, he was an art teacher, he retired, is still alive. He's about to be 91.
Wow, that's so nice for you.
That's great. It's great. Probably better for him because he's still alive. yeah, it was, you know, that my mom worked in the office at the high school where he taught in Chappaqua, and they went to work together every day, came home every day. So my dad was home when we were home after school, which was great. And then, you know, you do your homework or not do your homework. And then they were always cooking dinner together.
How many little Tuccis were running around, Stanley?
There were me and my two sisters, younger sisters. And it was wonderful, you know. I mean, it was in the time of, you know, there was one black and white television, and my father used to watch the Huntley-Brinkley Report. Is that what it was
we
called?
Did too. Yeah, right? Huntley-Brinkley Report on NBC.
Yeah, every night. And my mother cooked. My father was a sous chef. There was no sort of like, the man does this, the woman does this. It wasn't like that. Although she did do more of the cooking because she was really good at it. And then everybody pitched in and cleaned up, and you sat around the table and you had wonderful conversations, or you had arguments, or you had whatever. And it was, but every night was, I mean, I remember my mother just sort of making paella. That was extraordinary. We're suddenly, you know, making, you know, crepes, you know, with bechamel and chicken and, you know, just And you thought, she's gone to work. She's worked all day. Then she comes home and she does all this stuff. My dad helps her. And then, you know, it was an amazing, amazing culinary experience every week. Every week.
So she really infused in you and your dad, I think, a love of food. And
oh, yeah.
So that's kind of, from an early age, how you became kind of enamored with cuisine. And did they speak Italian? How did you become so proficient in Italian?
No, they didn't really speak. My father spoke some Italian. My mother spoke Italian, but more dialect. I learned in Florence when I was 12. We lived there for a year when I was 12. And then, of course, you know, you're 12, you speak fluently because you don't have much else up there.
Yeah.
So, you know, you become this sort of, you know, lingual sponge. But then when I was doing Big Night, I studied Italian again for about a year. And now before the series, I studied again. So every time I go, you know, it comes back. Suddenly it starts to come back. But I have to make a concerted effort to learn it properly because it disappeared.
Well, it sounds like you know what you're talking about. All I know is like grazie and prego and ciao. Yeah.
No, that's good enough. Okay.
So. I'd like to learn Italian. Maybe I'll do that. I think it would be good for my brain too.
No, it actually is new language. Really good to do. It is. I do it with a guy online. He's Italian. He was teaching here in England. We had like two sessions in person. And then it was like, I was like, don't drive all the way here and come. He was in, you know, North London or something. I was like, don't. We'll just do it on the, you know, this is pre-pandemic. And now he's moved to Spain where his wife is. And we just do it, you know, on Zoom like this. And it's great. And it's really, really great. It's really great. And we just, like, he does not allow me to speak in English, which is really painful for both of us.
I want to talk about the new book that's coming out. But first, I want to talk to you about Supernova and mm-hmm. this small but very moving movie that you did with my BFF, Colin.
Yes,
Firth,
yes.
For the uninitiated. And yeah. It is the story of two men who have been a couple for 20 years.
Yeah.
And it's a very quiet story that unfolds. And obviously your character is in early stages of dementia.
Yeah.
Teach me.
What? That? Hmm. Now? Why?
God. Want to learn?
No, I want to be able to find it.
All right.
Try.
Okay, so, first you have to find the, what do you call it? It's a shape, the shape.
Triangle.
The shape, yeah, triangle. And you have to find the three brightest lights there that make the triangle.
These ones.
Mm-hmm. Then draw a line horizontally through it. And that's where the Milky Way is.
What drew you to the role and why did you say, you must get a million scripts, Stanley, let's be honest. And no. You know, no, you, come on,
I
you do. Listen, it's the Tucci sans. It's the Tucci sans. Come on.
Yes, maybe now, yeah, but yeah.
But I'm curious, what has to happen to really suck you in and to say, I'm going to devote a lot of time making this movie. And what was it in this case?
It was the purity of the script and the poetry of it and the absence of drama and melodrama. It was gorgeous. it was a script that I that you read and you go, oh, I wish I'd written that. It's beautiful. But I was not going to play that role. I was going to play Colin's role. And then when I read it, I loved it so much. And I watched Harry's movie, Harry McQueen, who wrote and directed it. I watched his first film, which he had made for £10,000.
Wow.
So if any filmmaker thinks that they need a lot of money to make a movie.
Well, only when they have expensive actors like you, Stanley.
Yeah. But he made this really beautiful movie for £10,000. And then I watched it and then I met Harry and he was as wonderful as his writing and his filmmaking. And then I said, I think Colin should play the other guy. Now, unbeknownst to Harry, I slipped it to Colin. And Colin read it and he called me up. He goes, my God, it's so beautiful. I said, I know. So then Colin signed on. And very soon afterward, of course, the money came through. With me signed on, I'm not so sure what would have happened. But once that happened, Colin, we started talking with Harry and, you know, talking through it and everything. And then Colin called me and he goes, I think we have to switch roles. And I said, yeah, I was thinking the same thing. But I don't know why.
So I was going to say why. I mean, what was that?
I don't know. I don't know, Katie. I don't know. It just didn't feel right. So then, and that you can, this doesn't happen. I mean, you can only do that with your, like, best friend. And, you know, like, you can't go, hey, by the way, you know, when you're signed up for a project, I think we should switch roles, you know. And the studio goes, what? You know, no. So we go to Harry, and poor Harry, you know, blanched. And he said, all right, well, that's, you know, in typical sort of British fashion. Let's read it. So we read five scenes and then we switched roles because it was more right. I don't know why. There was something rhythmically more right about it being this way.
And the first scene is Colin and the two of you, I think I would say in a semi-spoon in bed. You're semi-spooning?
Yeah.
Not a full spoon, but a semi-spoon.
No, it's a teaspoon.
A teaspoon, yeah. And I don't know, was it fun doing this movie with someone who you're very close to and you really like, and you play a gay couple, so you know, I think it must be an added extra if you actually like your on-screen partner.
It helps if you trust and love the person that you're working with. It's always difficult to play a same-sex person if you're, you know, that's always more complicated. But in the end, you just want to tell that story truthfully. You know, it's complex, but ultimately, it's the story that makes the difference.
And I feel like this is illustrative. I don't know. I mean, you would know much more about this than I, but of this opening up of art and film to, you know, I hate to use sort of, you know, modern vernacular that is sometimes overused, but to make it more representative, more inclusive, more, you know, such a variety of experiences. I don't know. Do you feel that is really happening? In a significant way now, because just as a casual observer, I do, and I think it's so exciting and wonderful, and it makes you realize how myopically one-sided or one-dimensional a lot of our culture was.
Yes.
And I'm just curious if looking at the big picture, you notice that too.
Do you mean regarding
every different, I mean, gay stories, black stories, you know, all kinds of stories that I think heretofore were marginalized or really not told at all.
Yes, without question. I think what's happening now is a great thing. there were questions raised, of course, because neither Colin and I are gay, which it seems you'd be happy about. But I think, but I think that the wonderful thing is that we, for us, selfishly, we have been embraced by the gay community before, having played gay characters before, and in this film, the same thing has happened. I think that eventually, what is going to happen, and we've talked about this in interviews, that for me, it's a societal issue. Why gay actors have not been able to just be whomever they are. The more society is open, the more expansive the arts can be. Art is often a reaction to repression. But I think that I'm hoping that in America and here and throughout the world, that that will begin to change. And art can be then an expression or an extension of freedom and a new reality. And that reality is love is love. And it doesn't matter who it is that you love. And I think that's the beauty of that story of this film, is that love is love and loss is loss.
We're going through, I think, the growing pains of a shifting society. And, you know, we could talk about this a lot, but maybe over one of your Negronis one day. But, you know, this whole idea of, you know, opening the doors to people who were not represented before. And yet, I totally understand this, but the idea of having to have an actor who's portraying a certain role come from that role, I think that's a slippery slope too.
Yeah,
because
no,
aren't we all occupying, me, like I'm an actor, but aren't all actors occupying an alternate personage? And, you know, the idea that you have to be that person to occupy that space. I don't know. I find that challenging to wrap my head around.
No. And I don't believe in that. I just read this interview with Rupert Everett. And he said, no, I don't believe that gay actors should only play that no one who isn't gay should not be able to play a gay role.
And no one who is gay shouldn't be able to play a straight role.
Exactly. And that's the problem. That's the genesis of it.
Right.
The genesis is, as I said before, gay actors, gay people, were not allowed to simply be who they were in society. So if you can't be that, then you're hiding all the time. And then gay men are playing straight men, and only straight men. And then, so everyone is straight, right, in society. But, you know, but by the old sort of standards. And you're like, no, it doesn't make any sense. It makes no sense. So what? Once there's an opening, then anybody... It sounds so silly, but anyone then will be accepted playing anyone. Do you know what I mean?
Yes. Yes.
Am I making sense? Or
yes, you are. You are. I think what you're saying is.
I think you are. Yes.
No. I'm thinking about it. It's how we view people as a society that prevents or gives permission to people.
Right.
To play a whole host of roles, because I think that's what happened to Rupert Everett, right? I mean, he was typecast, and right? And I think the roles dried up for him because he was only viewed as a certain way, which was just patently unfair.
So. I don't know, but to me, Rupert's a wonderful actor. That's all I know. I don't know anything different than that. I don't care if a person, whatever their sexuality, I don't really care.
Well, I think the mores are just changing so much, and that people, you know, I think things have changed so dramatically. And I'm writing a memoir right now, and I just even look back on the 90s when I was covering stories, or, you know, some of the questions I asked, whether it was about sexual harassment with Anita Hill, or how I interviewed Matthew Shepard's parents, or how we covered Rodney King. You know, it was just in so many ways, Stanley, clueless. And I think that we have evolved so much. I mean, sometimes to the point where, you know, it comes crashing down on top of you if you haven't evolved enough. But it's really fascinating to me just how much in the last, two decades or so, our attitudes have shifted for the better. And I think that's what you're saying.
No, I think you're right. And I think particularly in the last, like, almost like 3 years.
Yeah,
like it's true. But that's also because of the technology.
It's technology, changed. But also, you know, two pretty dramatic social movements, you know, whether you're talking about Black Lives Matter, Me Too and Time's Up. You know, I think the confluence of those two movements have really put the issues front and center as they've never been before. Yeah. For the better, I think. You know, obviously, the pendulum can, in certain cases, swing too far. And, you know, I think no social justice movement is perfect. But I think it's, you know, I think that has really moved the ball forward in such a palpable, significant way.
But I want to ask you a question, if I may, that you have seen, you know, as a reporter for so many years, and it has distinctly changed for you. How do you feel now about when you're talking to people? Is it easier for you now, or is it harder for you now? Because there are so many caveats in a way.
Right. I think they're,
obviously, of course. This is your thing, so you can just cut it out.
No. Yeah. I mean, I think I think that, you know, cultural conditioning, deep-seated attitudes that are formed and, you know, compounded over years and years of visual stimuli, you know, conversations, mass media, you know, familial kind of, I think, outlooks, you know, they form us as a person. And I think what's really hard is to, you know, be vulnerable enough to kind of challenge your own biases, which have developed over the years.
Yes.
I think that, you know, it can be tricky because I think the current landscape, you know, people want to jump on people right away, right? This instantaneous judgment. And there's very little forgiveness in the culture. There's very little forgiveness for mistakes. Yeah. And I've made my fair share of mistakes, certainly. And When you're a public figure, it can be very tough and very painful, honestly.
Yeah.
I would hope that people can recognize fair-minded individuals who want to learn and want to be better, but it doesn't happen overnight necessarily. You know, 60 years of conditioning. So I try to be mindful. I try not to say stupid things, but I also, you know, I like compassionate teachers. You know, I think that, you know, and by the way, you know, this is me coming from me as a 64-year-old who has had certain life experiences and privileges, and I get that. But you know, it can be tricky, And I pride myself on being a lifelong learner and being open to understanding. And I think, you know, I really appreciate the opportunity. And I, more than that, I appreciate the changes I'm witnessing. And, but I think for some people, it does take adjusting. And once in a while, I think a little bit of slack can be a good thing.
You know, I agree.
But I have my 25-year-old extremely woke daughter there to keep me in line every step of the way. How about you? Do your kids, your older kids, not your little ones?
Yeah.
Do you feel like they're educating you on some of these things?
Yes, always, always. They educate you on who you are. It's always changing. It's always different. I think particularly in the pandemic, because there's no consistency. Who knows, you know, when somebody's living here or there, when they're going to go back to school, when they can come back home and stay. And, you know, one of my daughters went and stayed with her boyfriend for like almost 6 weeks. And rightly so. I mean, she's 21 years old and, you know, and then, but he was staying with us for a while before that. And so I don't know.
It's
the whole thing is everything is heightened and exacerbated. Any issues, good or bad, are exacerbated by this pandemic.
But do they teach you about kind of, you know, I feel like young people are so aware and so much better than we are in some ways.
Yes.
And when it comes to kind of societal issues and change and you know, these thorny matters of race and gender and class, do you feel like, you know, I first heard the word intersectionality from my daughter. And
what's the word?
Intersectionality. It's about the intersection of race and gender. And, you know, she's so smart, but that's what I meant. Do they kind of open your eyes and challenge perhaps some of the ways you've thought about things to say, Dad, have you ever considered this?
Without question. I think the only thing that I fear, and this is inevitable, when things sort of start to tilt in another direction in an extreme
or
way.
Or too far, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Is a lack of irony. And I think that irony is absolutely crucial to our existence. It is the sort of genesis or the basis of all humor, of good humor.
Right.
No. So I fear the loss of irony when somebody makes a joke and you're like, oh, you're a racist or oh, you're a sexist or oh, you're a blah, blah, blah. And you're like, no, it was just, you know, there was something sort of not even a joke, just a, you know, something. So I fear the loss of irony, but I do think that eventually things come around, and this is a natural progression.
I think earnestness and irony are probably they're not the best cocktail, right?
No, they're not the best cocktail, but they can. It's like a Pousse Café. Do you know what a Pousse Café is?
I don't.
Okay, so a Pousse Café. If I look at that print behind you or painting behind you.
Yeah.
So it's layers. So what you do with the Pousse Café is you take the heaviest liquor and you put, you know, a drop in, you know, a shot. Then you take another liquor and you put it in. And they lay on top of one another. It's a very complicated drink. It can be made with like 7, 14, or 21 liquors, something insane. No one would ever... I mean, it's disgusting, but visually it's quite beautiful. And so you layer it. And that's the way those two things sort of have to sit like that. But in, at the same time, you we have to let them come together. We have to let earnestness and irony come together. And we go through periods of time where that happens, and then it changes again. I think in, you know, yeah, it changes. We'll get
that's
there.
A good.
We'll get there again.
Yeah, we just need a good shaker, like the ones you use, like the ones you use for your cocktails on Instagram. Yes. Wasn't that a seamless transition?
Hey, come on, who are you talking to?
Stanley Tucci, of course, the hot mixologist. We'll get behind those cocktails right after this. I've gotten such a kick out of you. First of all, hilariously, you're the sauce man, as you know, Stanley. Yeah. And but also as the hot mixologist on Instagram. So yeah. How did that all start? Obviously, your wife Felicity, who I'm so happy that you met Felicity, and you know, you talked about love is love and loss is loss. You lost your wife. I lost my husband. So that's why I feel like we actually can talk about that, because we have that in common. But I guess you and Felicity, first of all, can I ask you real quickly about your meeting? Because you were at Emily Blunt and John, I always say his name wrong, Krasinski, right?
Krasinski, no, you said it
Krasinski's,
wrong.
Yeah. Krasinski's wedding. Yeah. I love him, by the way. I just don't say his name very often. And that's when you met Felicity, Emily's sister. And she had you at hello, right?
No, not really. we actually had met at the Devil Wears Prada premiere. And I talked to her for a while, but she ended up really talking to Kate, my late wife, a lot about books, because, you know, they're voracious readers. And I actually have a photograph of them together.
That's so moving, actually.
That Felicity's mom took. Yes, then I went to Em's wedding, and this was, maybe a year? No. Yeah, a year after Kate had passed away. And we met and remet, and we hit it off, and then I was coming to England to do Captain America, and I know I played the elderly Jewish scientist who created Captain America, which was actually, I have to say, one of the best jobs I've ever had in my life. And then we started, you know, going out to dinner, and we started dating. And then, that was that.
And one thing led to another, and you all had two children.
Yeah.
And this wonderful new life together. So I'm just very happy for you both. Yeah. And I feel like Felicity was sort of behind the Instagram cocktail making that you. Oh,
totally. I mean, you know, I have no savvy when it comes to this stuff. So she said, why don't you do a cocktail? Beginning of lockdown, first lockdown. She said, do a cocktail for Curtis Brown, our agency where she works, and I'm represented by them. And I said, yeah, all right. It'll just be an in-house thing. And, you know, you do it. And I said, yeah, great. And then we did it and sent it to everyone, and they were so happy. And she said, put it on your Instagram. So we did that. And meaning, I don't actually know how to do it, but, you know.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, you know what I mean. And then, that happened.
It blew up, as the kids say, Stanley.
It blew up. Yeah. We crashed it.
So, yeah. I think you don't say, you say we crushed it or we crashed
it. Oh, crushed it. That's the word. Sorry. Yeah. It's so old. Jesus.
Before we go, I want to give a quick shout out to your upcoming book.
Yes.
So what is this one about and when does it come out?
Well, it's a memoir of sorts. It's called Taste, My Life Through Food. And it's exactly that, up to now, because I don't know.
Honey, give me a better elevator pitch than that.
Yeah. And it's just about, like, you know, growing up and eating great things, and then, you know, a little bit about Julie and Julia, some little anecdotes there and things like that. And, you know, sometimes it delves into the particulars of pasta and bolognese and experiences with that. Sometimes, you know, it's just, I don't know what it is. I've never done anything like it. I'm going through the, you know, copy edits now,
That right now.
You are?
Yeah. I have a memoir that is actually due yesterday, Stanley.
Oh,
and
my
I've
God.
Been going, yeah. And I've been working on it for about 2.5 years and I'm going through everything now. And I don't know. I'm sort of panicked right now that, gosh, it makes you feel very vulnerable. You're putting something out in the world. It's extremely personal. It's ridiculously honest. It's, you know, about, honestly, it's the only memoir I'll ever write. It's about my life and how I got into this crazy business and sort of the tragedies and the triumphs.
No, of course.
And,
you went through a real loss.
But you know, and also I've had some professional disappointments. Yeah. I've dealt with some, you know, real dicks in the business. And and so I am like putting this out there and all of a sudden I'm seized by terror that I'm doing this. And I kind of just want to put the whole thing in a fire. Do you feel that ever?
Yes,
or
of
is
course.
This just
yeah,
me?
No, as I'm going through it today, I thought, what am I doing? Who cares? You know, who cares? And also it's like, why would you want to? But I want to tell the story. Do you know what I mean? I want to tell the story of food in, I'm fascinated by it, but to tell the story of food, I have to tell the story about myself.
Right. And that's hard and scary.
Yeah. Really scary. Really. Yeah.
Well, I'm glad you're feeling the same way. Yeah, that makes
terrifying.
Me feel a little bit
so
better.
You're going through the same.
Totally.
I was
totally like not sleeping, worried and self full, just full of self doubt, doubt and, you know, bordering on loathing.
Yes, of course. Yes. Yes. Yeah.
Anyway, well, listen, I feel like this has been a really helpful therapy session for me,
well,
Stanley.
I'll do anything I can to help you. You know that.
Thank you. Oh. And I want you to be able to be with your children, but I really love talking to you. Thank you for doing our little podcast, Stanley.
Oh, no, well, thank you. And I really appreciate it. I'm glad it worked out. And I just think you're wonderful.
Oh, thanks, Stanley. I love Stanley Tucci. If you're also on the Tucci train, you've got to check out this SNL short, Tucci Gang, with Pete Davidson singing and Sam Rockwell giving us some good Tucci energy.
Let's get it!
Tucci Gang, Tucci Gang, Tucci Gang, Tucci Gang.
It is a riot.
Some of you don't know the name, but that's that guy from the Hunger Games.
Next Question with Katie Couric is a production of iHeartMedia and Katie Couric Media. The executive producers are me, Katie Couric, and Courtney Litz. The supervising producer is Lauren Hansen. Associate producers, Derek Clements, Adriana Fazio, and Emily Pinto. The show is edited and mixed by Derek Clements. For more information about today's episode or to sign up for my morning newsletter, Wake Up Call, go to katiecouric.com. You can also find me at Katie Couric on Instagram and all my social media channels. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.